Its archetypes define our dreams and our art. Its patterns define our science and our society. Well, how about specifically Sicily? Here's a story, a deeply resonant story that takes us from civilization from Lebanon, from the Phoenicians, across the Mediterranean to Greece, and then following into Sicily. We are deep in the stony, tangible realities of the Mediterranean mythos. The Sicanians, the Sicels, the Olympians, all of them had a social relationship with the land, as well as a sacred one. That is, they lived with the land as a companion. And the Greeks came here and found the land more alive, perhaps, than the land back in Greece was to them anymore. This new land was more fertile. It was more unknown, more full of possibilities, dangerous possibilities. In that sense, the goddess here was more active. And the need to communicate with the goddess, to address the goddess, was more acute here. There are, however, challenges to the Earth goddess, and I think some of these have also been discussed in addresses here at this conference. The first I want to mention, just in passing, because we've been over this, is arete, the Greek sense of excellence, which has many, many meanings, many, many ways in which excellence can be known. But if you go to the Minoan Middle Bronze Age, you have a society that's fairly, confidently say, was deeply steeped in the goddess, the understanding of the earth as feminine, in the idea of the labyrinth, in caves, in horned mountains. And as the sort of comic book survey of Western culture has it, a simplified story, is that Mycenae swept down and brought this male warrior ethic along and dethroned the goddess. That's too simplistic, but it gets us going in the right direction. This idea of arete, of male glory, of the warrior ethic, of a man achieving excellence by his deeds. And of course, here's a story that's embodied in the stories of Sicily. We begin with her. Here's a creature of the West, as far as the Greeks are concerned, a goddess of the West, and her roots go deep into the idea of the earth goddess and the many manifestations of the earth goddess, the powers of the earth, the thnotic power to ward off evil is one place the Gorgon comes from. The three Gorgon sisters, of which Medusa was the only mortal one. And thus, Medusa was the one that Perseus was able to go and kill and defeat. And as Perseus came down to defeat Medusa, he made off with her head. He defeated the Grey Sisters first, another aspect of the feminine, and then he made off with the head of Medusa, and thus made off with her power, with mnemonic power, to ward off evil. And what's the first thing he did was he rescued Andromeda. And there's Andromeda, chained to a rock, the archetype of the helpless woman. There she is, the damsel waiting to be rescued by the knight. There she is, poor Nell, tied to the railroad tracks, waiting for W.W. Wright to come and rescue her. You have the feminine archetype that's most congenial to the male warrior ethic is the first thing he does upon defeating the Medusa, the feminine archetype of the dangerous earth powers, and taking the power away. My slide is slightly out of order, but we'll get to it. The second place Sicilian story that brings up this theme is Erice, this wonderful rock off the coast of western Sicily. There, the story is, Aphrodite is flying by, sees a sailor, Boeotes, swimming along, plucks him out of the sea, takes him to the top of Erice and rapes him. Now there's a switch. The goddess rapes the god, the mortal. But in walks, guess who, Heracles, to take over the story. takes over the mountain first by wrestling, which is the male power, once again, taking over the story. And he then takes over the mountain itself by, he takes over the story by announcing his descendants would then come and rule thereafter this mountain. So you have this situation of the of an older story with this ending tacked on to reflect a new dispensation. That's one way in which the goddess is supposedly overthrown. However, my thesis is that the goddess is not in fact overthrown at all. If Heracles' descendants returned to that, yes, sir.
Which goddess was it who raised the god?
Not the god, the mortal. It was Aphrodite.
Aphrodite.
Yes, thank you. I claim she was not overthrown, because if Heracles had come back and his people had ruled Eretche, it's not reflected in the worship up there, because the goddess worship remained there. And we have what became under Roman time the most important goddess site of fertility worship in the central Mediterranean. Going back to Carthagene and Astarte, and then Aphrodite, and then Venus, until under the Romans, Eretche was a place of a massive temple complex of 100 priestess prostitutes, all in service of Venus. Reflecting a very powerful sense of the power of the goddess there. You can't suppress the goddess any more than you can suppress human sexuality, or any more than you can suppress the notion that the need for us to repose ourselves in the bosom of our mother, essentially. In fact, looking at it even further, I find that these male assertions of power remind me of a little boy trying to find some space from his mother.
Yep.
Recall that unlike other religions, the Greek gods were not creator gods. They themselves were created by the earth, which is not common in most religions. The gods were the children of the earth. In fact, they were the grandchildren of the earth. In fact, they were the unwanted grandchildren of the earth. In fact, the earth tried to snuff them out. And that reflects a fact that the earth remains a proper grandmother, being watching, being in control, and occasionally disciplining the gods, and also having the final say, like a proper grandmother. Recall that even the peak of the warrior ethic was erased. The warrior culture in its archetypal story, the Iliad, was in fact erased because of a fight over a woman. And its archetypal hero, Achilles, ends up being erased from the story, erased from further Greek legends, Greek myth. Essentially, he's sent down to Hades because he's irrelevant to the new dispensation, which is going to be Odysseus, which is going to be the clever man, the intellectual man, the thinker. And this takes us into a new direction. And when we get to the Odyssey, we find our hero on his wits, not on his muscle power, surviving, and just barely surviving, a whole series of feminine archetypes. I mean, this is old terrain for anyone who's read or studied the Odyssey, so I'm not going to leave it here, but we know this. And even at the end of the Odyssey, it's the female that wins. It is said, as you know, the Iliad begins with the word wrath. The rage, the wrath of Achilles, propels that story. There's a very male moment. The Odyssey ends, the story arc ends in the bed of Penelope, the female. And just to put a coda on it, then Athena steps in and sorts the whole thing out and cleans up the final loose ends of the story. You have what is essentially a story that reinserts the female into what would have been a warrior ethic. So there's a tension here. There is the male warrior coming back and defeating the earth, and then the earth coming back and bringing him in and bringing him back around. And this is what we have in tragedy. This is the essence of Greek tragedy. There's a lot of opinion I'm spouting out here. Right? People are going to disagree with this, but this is my own take on this. This is my rostrum on this for an hour. Greek tragedy. What happened last night? Classic example. You have this masculine male will, unbounded, running without containment, going over the born into hubris. And what does he refuses to put a little bit of Mother Earth onto a body. just an acknowledgement of the power of the earth that, that's more important than him. And he refuses to do so. What happens? Everything collapses. The revenge is hard and bitter and total. It's not presented as, quote, the revenge of the earth, but that's what happens. And that's what he's warned of Tiresias, and he's warned about this. He said, don't mess with Mother Nature, if you give the film a cliche. And if you look consistently across Greek tragedy, it's that same tension. And that's why Greek tragedy is a religious event. That's why these festivals were religious festivals. You went there to get a sermon, and the sermon was Mother Nature's in charge. Human will has its goal, has its purpose, but Mother Nature has to be respected, and she will contain. Mother Nature, it's like, again, it's a little boy. He runs out, he climbs trees, he breaks stuff, he fights, he's disobedient, and then Mom brings him back, corrects him, admonishes him, and is the final word. Maternal nature contains our strivings, punishes our excesses, holds us within limits. Now, there's a second challenge to the goddess, which is, back up a bit, here we go, which is our urban world. It's a world that really begins to affect this situation by the Hellenistic period. The urban landscape, the urban value system, and the technological, which comes from that. And people begin defining human values in urban terms. And that their Sicilian myth is right there to embody that. Already, the handwriting is on the wall when Polyphemus throws great boulders at the fleeing, the Nervians, Odysseus. Here are the boulders just off the coast north of Catania, Achitensa. This is our proof that it happened here, but then some dispute is the way it's going to happen. We have boulders. It's right on the map. Says so. And it was a case of he's already defeated. Polyphemus is already blinded. He's been defeated. The guy got away. And he, in frustration, he's throwing the boulders. Well, this is early. And it shows the beginnings of a change. Polyphemus still can appeal to the earth, to the sea, to the, you know, nature. His father, Poseidon, who brings horrible wrath back down on Odysseus, but only to a limited extent, but he does bring his wrath, so the earth still has power to punish. 500 years later, a little less than 500 years later, Hellenistic Sicily, we have Theocritus. And Theocritus takes Polyphemus, the Cyclops, and gives us another version of him. And Theocritus is the beginnings of, is the urban poet, not the beginnings of urban and cities, because that goes way back, but beginnings of this urban sensibility. And Polyphemus now is no longer the roaring monster. Polyphemus is a lovesick old lump of a hump of a guy. He's an object of pity. He's every awkward guy who doesn't get the girl. There he is, up there, poor old Othello, playing his pipe, as his girlfriend, the shameless bitch, Galatea, who's hanging out with the shepherd, not just now, she has every right to hang out with who she wants, but she's very cruel to him. In fact, she used to sit there with Scylla, and Scylla would be combing her hair, and they'd be very catty about poor old Polyphemus, who's up there singing beautiful, some of the most beautiful poetry I know are the idylls of Theocritus, the words of Polyphemus, trying to convince Galatea to come. I'm just a big ugly, I only got one eyebrow across my forehead, but I offer you my cane, I offer you the finest of cloth and shoes. It's very sad, really. But, of course, this story, so here we have the beginnings of the demotion of the earth. And Polyphemus is not a feminine figure, but he's the man of the earth. He's the brute force of the earth. Of course, he still has power to punish. So we haven't lost it. The earth has been weakened, but Polyphemus can still bring wrath. And he does this by squashing, dropping the boulder on poor Axius, the lover of Galatea. And, well, that takes us one step away from earth's power towards reducing it and making it into a picture. Now it's a Greek story. Well, we moderns have taken it further, of course. For example, Handel's Axius and Galatea. It's his pretty little genre piece. He said, my little opera. And it made the whole thing into a pastoral it's essentially now turned it into the picture I was talking about. And nature, you know, and Paul Polyphemus gets no respect at all.
Yeah.
So we have what I was saying, which is the power of nature being reduced to a picture. A two-dimensional version of the mother that we neglected. And this becomes essentially what divorced from the land, we miss our former mother. Actually, I'm using the wrong analogy. Neglecting our mom, we miss our mom. And we look for the power of land and heart. And so, with the Hellenistic period, again, these are gross generalizations, but we begin to get into the profusion of landscape painting, descriptive writing, bucolic poetry, which Diocletus invents, picturesque architecture, two-dimensional forms of the mom that we're neglecting. Makes you want to sit on the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. What about our modern myths? I'm not going to get into those. Because that's a whole other area. The validity of them, or whether they're toxic, as some have said, Jensen said they're toxic. But my point is that we can only make sense, we can only act out of who we are. We're defined by how we're made. And not defined by where we think we're going, but by who we are. Hermes is another whole sideline I can talk about. I'm going to head off on Hermes as the man of transition, the man of transformation himself, and the man who mediates between humanity and the earth and the powers of the earth. And that has to do with remaining open, because it is said that when a room grows quiet, Hermes has entered the room. Mm-hmm. The Greeks thought. We're no longer talking, we're listening. And that's where he shows up. Well, what are our rituals? I mean, how do we talk with the goddess? Well, you can only speak with the goddess by ritual. You can't just tell the stories. The stories without the ritual are dead. You've got to do the ritual. They're just pretty stories otherwise. Who knows what the modern ritual is? A lot of people have said, but I'm talking about the rituals of the earth. Let's go back to the Greeks. The rituals are multiple, but what kinds of rituals did we have with the earth back when we were on speaking terms with her? Think sacred drama. Think what you saw last night. That's a classic ritual. Of the people going and participating in, they weren't actually on stage, but they were there in this rite of communication with the powers of the earth. Think sacred dance, think sacred music, generative, participatory rituals. Experiences where one crosses a kind of bridge, where one goes into a condition of contradictions. I want to thank Scott Olson for his Platonic Solids, talking about getting into natural resonance by building these things. There's this ritual, he's building these solids, and by building them, you're participating in something which is part of the Earth's language. Think Eleusinian Mysteries. Think the Passover Seder. Think Catholic Mass, but only if you can experience it with true belief in the real presence. I'm not Catholic, but from looking back at its roots in Greek sacrifice, only if it is real blood or becomes real blood in the ritual does it have any meaning, does it have any roots in the earth. It has to have that transubstantiation, or you don't have it. It's just a story, and it's no longer a participatory ritual. Well, the Greeks, there you go, there's a fine example of an unknown participatory ritual, dancers as horses. Who knows what's going on? This is what the place looks like when it's not covered by planking during the theater season. For 10 months out of the year, this is what you visit. And one can talk on and on about what you see here, and about us being put up there in honor of Aeschylus showing up in Syracuse, etc. I do want to make a point, linguistic, a etymology point. This is a theater. An amphitheater, the prefix amper, means round. It also means two. I mean, you can take two different etymologies. But nonetheless, amphitheater is a round theater. That is the Colosseum, or the Roman amphitheater here. When it's only a half circle, that's a theater, not an amphitheater. Just to clear up that terminology point. Well, the Greeks, again, to be mostly simplistic, and we're talking about the pre, I don't know how to put this, but anyway, the pre-classical, or it overlapped. Let's say the pre-Hellenistic Greeks tended to live within the story. Here's my quotation from Diodorus. Sicily is the first and most powerful of the islands because of its history and its myth. Those should be quotation marks. This machine's doing weird things with my slides. Note what he says. Two things. One is history and myth make an island powerful. Not as economy, not as military. But from his point of view, what really matters is that history and myth make an island powerful. The second thing is, Sicily is the most important. Now, in the present tense, even though history and myth are back there, because he's late, and he's talking about the myths that have come through the generations, and the history that has happened here, all are living in the present. It's in the present tense. And that's how you live the history, you live the myth, as present tense. It's all present. You know, the past isn't gone, it's not your past. It's inevitable, but I'm just quoting Faulkner there. But you know the point. The ritual is the event. It can be the telling of the event. If you're going to tell the event, you have to be doing the ritual. And of course, in a sense, we are living the stories. Anyway, I mean, we are all actors in history. We're all characters in history, regardless of what we're doing. And history is a flood that's far overpowering our puny wills to have any very much effect on. So we're all characters in history, and characters in the present tense. And in fact, the historical site, when you visit it, is asking from you that you participate in the emotional life of the place that you're visiting, as it once flourished. And because you're standing there, it continues to flourish. So you are entering the history of the site you visit, and you should feel that there. We are all characters in the myths. It could be a toxic myth, it could be a whole and complete myth, but we are characters in the myth whether we're paying attention or not. The experience myth is one that has a continuous dialogue of continuous humanity with continuous nature. All inclusive and all in the present tense. So, what land am I talking about? What is the land, the goddess? Let's get very specific. Let's talk about, because everything is specific. Let's be specific. Where are we right now? We're in southeastern Sicily. And the land I'd like to talk about is the Hebraic. And the Hebraic, Monte Hebraic, is this highland. If you look toward inland, you see it immediately. The ground lifts up. And that takes you all across southeastern Sicily. The whole southeastern corner of Sicily is called Monte Hebraic. It's riven by deep chasms and then this limestone upland region. The wheat economy, of course, dry stone walls, olives, carob trees, which is what you see here, ricotta, the best possible ricotta cheese. The Iblay's own story is a story of the unending creek of geology. The slow softening seep of water, the poised waiting leap of earthquakes. Forgive me, I'm married to a poet, I get carried away. Our restless strivings enter the slow time of this land. And the land absorbs our strivings and holds it in place. Here is, those are the Sicel tombs of Pantalica. This wonderful natural area that had the Sicel city, and now it's just the echoes of the people, what remains of us, but the land has taken back into itself from our presence on it. At its most I think that the Iblay area is this dance between man and landscape at its most balanced. It's most metronomic, if I can put it that way. The quiet tick, tick, tick. This didn't show up very well. This is a poem by Patty Trimble. There is wonder, there's wonder only light in rows plowed through a field, and how the farmer knows the hill, how tractor furrowed lines must yield to earth's design. Soil is barely spare enough skin to stretch across the ribs, so plowing proves the bone beneath, and every prayer must drive across and down and up around the hill and curve along the sweep. Every prayer must conform to the land. One hears the land through one's hands and feet, and one prays to the land with one's hands and feet. Here is C.S. Lewis. Men of the people, like the shepherds, had everywhere been the makers of mythologies. It was they who had felt most directly, with least check or chill from philosophy or the corrupt cult of civilization, the need. The mythology was a source of search, the tempting and tantalizing hints of something half-human in nature, the dumb significance of season in special places. It's an important point for you, special places. They had best understood, the people, the shepherd, the people on the land had best understood that the soul of the landscape is a story, and the soul of the story is a personality. The landscape is a story at its heart. How did the Greeks enter that story? Well, a number of ways. I'm just going to bounce through this. The temple placement is one. A place on the planet was holy before the Greeks put a temple on it, or rather they put a temple on a spot because it was holy. And a temple is not a place, an interior space. You go in to worship the goddess, as you might a church. A temple is an exterior piece of sculpture whose purpose is to hold a dialogue with the land it's standing in. Building plus landscape equals the statement, the architectural statement. Building plus landscape is the spiritual conversation. But the land shapes us more deeply and more subtly than we shape the land. I find myself, when I walk the Iblay, thinking of Auden. Auden's poem, In Praise of Limestone, 1948. I'll quote passages from it. Form the one landscape that we, the inconstant ones, are constantly homesick for. We are home. You don't know it, but you're homesick for this landscape. Yeah, maybe if you're sensitive, you feel it when you're out there. This is chiefly because it dissolves in water. Mark these rounded slopes with their surface fragments of time, and beneath a secret system of caves and conduits. Here are the springs that spurt out everywhere with a chuckle. A spring gushes from a rock, a perfectly ordinary thing, but a perfectly ordinary advantage in Sicily, anywhere in the landscape. Atris and Galatea. Atris spots out of a rock now, telling us a story of enduring love. Arethusa, right over here. Arethusa emerges from a rock and tells a story of love, the consummation of love, perfect love, or perhaps at least perfect sex, as the merging of waters. Arethusa tells another story, a political story, about the Greeks' claim to ownership of the land, or to not ownership of the land, they would have put it that way, their claim to be there, to worship on this particular spot. Arethusa tells that land story as well. But a limestone landscape chuckles. That's I think, the key when I get into this. It's not fearsome, it's not sublime, it's a conversation on a human scale. And that takes us to temple design. Here is one of the great buildings in the world. You can hit it with a spiritual stone and you can hit it. This is not, I mean, this is a sacred grove. It is not representing a sacred grove. It is not imitating a sacred grove. It is a sacred grove of trees. Idealized, because that's what the gods would do. It's not the oval, but look at the scale. It seems impressive. but it's not the overwhelming, pitiless nature of Mesopotamia. Nor is it the awesome Gothic tower of a Gothic cathedral, for instance, whose purpose is to awe. That's probably a very challenging thing, it's a very contentious thing to say, but the awesomeness of it. When you bring in awe, you're no longer at a human scale. And I think as awesome as the gods were, the gods dealt with and were thought in terms of human scale. And this is a grove of trees. And a grove of trees is something we can grasp. We can conceive it within our level. Not a soaring forest, but one with limitation. And it's very humble. The Baroque fits that. The Gothic, of course, never took root down here. It never got imported down here. The land rejects it. But the Baroque does. But when the Baroque comes down here, it becomes more vegetative than it does elsewhere. It also is a way the land speaks. The land speaks in the Baroque as it speaks in the classical. It speaks in the Baroque because it's what it expresses is small statements, small vegetative statements, a profusion of small statements, which is very, again, on the human scale, which is why it works down here. And why we have this UNESCO World Heritage designation for seven towns in Hiblay. Hiblay is the place of Sicilian Baroque. And it's achieved a magnificence here because it grows out of this soil. It's a way the soil has of telling us what it wants us to do. We're not the sculptures. We're not the stone carvers. We are simply the tools that the land uses to express itself through us. Another way that works is in ethics. How does it shape the character of people who live on it? The limestone landscape, with its human scale, taught the Greek, and here's a better one of my thesis statements, taught the Greek the virtue of nothing to excess. The middle course between extremes. A land that lacks extremes teaches us to be bounded and not to go to extremes. This is the point Auden also gets to in his poem. Here is the Messina Strait, where you pass between Scylla and Charybdis. The myth charts a course between one who loved her father too little, and the punishment of one who loved her father too little, and the punishment of one who loved her father too much. Those are the background stories of the two women who ended up as Scylla and Charybdis, or Scylla and Charybdis, they should be saying. Two extremes. Similar to this, in the same category, is the Delphic Know Thyself, which could be interpreted as, I think is interpreted as, know where you are centered. Know, which means also, its corollary is know your extremes, and chart a middle course between your extremes. The middle course will get you through the strait. The Mediterranean landscape is not a place for large treks, not a place for great distances. People grow up, according to Auden again, adjusted to the local needs of valleys, where everything can be touched or reached by walking. It's a landscape of soft rock whose virtues and vices are our own. In fact, it taught us its virtues and vices, to take a strong statement of that thesis. Here, the epic is redeemed by pettiness. The horrific is very, very dire. And the conflict is usually bounded by domesticity. And all these could be elaborated with examples, but I think that's essentially getting at it. Auden again. Examine this region of short distances and definite places. Short distances and definite places. What could be more like mother, or a fitting background for her son, the nude young male who lounges against the rock, displaying his dildo, never doubting that for all his faults, he is loved, whose works are but extensions of his power to charm. From weathered outcrop to hilltop temple, from appearing waters to conspicuous fountains, from a wild to a formal vineyard, are ingenious but short steps that a child's wish to receive more attention than his brothers can easily take. It takes the story to break it down to simple, human, even childlike terms. of how we grow up and how we deal with the world as children, as in a world that's bounded by that kind of eternal mother. And I think whatever one does here in the Hiblay, in the limestone, I'm not just talking one region of Sicily, I'm not just talking about Sicily. The thesis works in a limestone landscape in the Mediterranean area. Whatever one does here is in the embrace of soft, weathered, grounded grace, of unquestioning, even though strangling, typically strangling, all forgiving eternal love. Well, where does the earth mother meet the limestone goddess, the limestone goddess, the limestone mother meet the earth goddess? Some place that we've hit upon, almost every talk has taken us there, into a grotto or a cave, which takes us to Kubla Khan's deep romantic cavern. It's clearly a limestone landscape that can only be that. The Greeks arrived in Sicily with a narrative already here. There it is. I knew I had it. Okay, I just read that. And here is more Sicel 2. The Greeks arrived with a narrative already here. A narrative of a land empowered and a maternal a narrative of the deep underground womb-like power of the earth erupted from below or accessible from the passage back and forth. The original Sicanians claim that they themselves came from the deep earth. Their whole peoples came out of the deep earth. The Sicanians, in pre-Greek. We hear of a cult of drowning that was anciently practiced out of the Porticina. It was already a holy site before Hades went down in there with struggling Persephone. The Sicels listen to the earth at Palike, which is at this on the south edge of the plain of Catania. Again, before pre-Greek. And here is Diodorus, the myth that relates to the sacred air, surpasses all others in antiquity, the reverence paid for it, paid to it. The craters were filled with extraordinary streams of water from a depth beyond telling. Sulfurous smell, the yawning mouth emits a mighty, terrifying roar. Since so divine a majesty pervades the sacred air, the most sacred oaths are taken here, etc. Judgment is passed here. Men are punished here. Palike no longer roars. It no longer erupts. Possibly because we don't believe anymore. But again, I thank Leonard George for being so expressive in Parmenides' Underworld. And he's got another workshop coming up that's going to get it back into the caves. So we won't have to talk too much of the caves as a place of birth and rebirth or transcendence. A couple of Sicilian examples. This is in Crete, but Odysseus, of course, was told by Circe that he had to go to the underworld. And he went there, wasn't in Sicily, he passed the Straits of Gibraltar, but he went there to learn maturity, to learn, in my take on it, that suffering was necessary. Circe, by the way, is another ancient pre-Greek earth goddess. And she tells him he has to suffer. He has to learn about suffering. And of course, he goes to learn that suffering is necessary, and his teacher in that will be Sicily, because, of course, suffering is what Sicily does best. The water nymph, Arethusa, there's that river Alpheus flowing in Greece before it comes out right over here, pops out over here. She learned about suffering and going to maturity. She emerges, she descends into the earth, into the underworld as a virgin, afraid. She appears right over here as a mature woman, having learned about love and learned about sexual commitment in Sicily. And then, of course, the examples abound, but another one that relates to Sicily, D.H. Lawrence, who met his snake here. Well, again, one of the great poems of the 20th century, if you love this sort of subject matter. The quote, he met the snake, the king in exile, uncrowned in the underworld. The Dionysian, the Freudian id, is hypnotic, uncontrolled, that materialized almost by magic and then disappeared in a manner very troubling to a superego. And forcing Lawrence to examine himself. And when he examined himself, he found himself wanting. The underground can mean expiation. Grotto is a place, of course, of deep Dionysian urges, of penetration, the womb of the mother, source of regeneration. Here's C.S. Lewis again. The barbarian who conceived the crudest fancy about the sun being stolen and hidden in a box, or the wildest myth about the god being rescued and his enemy deceived with a stone, was nearer to the secret of the cave and knew more about the crisis of the world than all those in the circle of cities around the Mediterranean who had become content with cold abstractions or cosmopolitan generalizations. The secret of the cave. What he's saying, of course, is that to know about the crisis of the world, you have to go into a cave. Think paleolithic cave painters. Back to this one. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, back to that cave. On the Egadi Islands off of Trapani. Think Dionysian rites in the dark. Think Hermes, Mr. Transformation, who was born in a cave. Think Zeus, who was reared in a cave. Think Christ, who was born in a cave. Obviously, says the limestone landscape, your salvation must come from a cave. But equally obviously, says the limestone landscape, your salvation will not save you. And that brings us to the land as tragedy, which brings us directly to Sicily. History and myth are two different narratives of a place. They're both human inventions, and yet both express truth that's too deep for humans to invent. When I was a kid, I held the vaguest sense that my grandmother was born into a deeply rooted, ancient, and meaningful narrative. I think she couldn't have expressed any sense of that, but I remember thinking of her in that way, somehow, in vague terms, and I remember her, the sense of grounded steadiness, and the sadness that one would find in the worry lines of her smile. There's a sense that she carried although she was a very cheerful woman, she carried a deep, quiet sense of tragedy deep behind her that I now recognize as Sicilian. I came to Sicily in midlife feeling something similar, very viscerally, as I mentioned already, that I was lacking a deep narrative, and I came here in search of it. Well, I hate to be obvious about it, but among the narratives of this land, we keep coming back to it because you can't not come back to it here in Sicily, is Demeter and Persephone. There they are. There's the libation being fulfilled, Persephone pouring the libation on the ground, Demeter with her sheaves of wheat, the mother and the daughter. Why? Because Sicily continues to live it. So it's still a living story here. Always a living myth is one in which we keep cycling through and living over and over and over again. And as been pointed out, the myth settles perfectly nicely in Enna. There's Enna right in the middle of Enna's in the pivot point of Sicily, the very heart of Sicily, even as Sicily is at the center, the exact center and pivot point of the Mediterranean. So we have something which even geographically is beautifully positioned to be central story. And the cloud-born, thank you for Leonard for showing a picture of Enna, which I didn't have, up there in its clouds on its butte, is the place to talk about the underworld. That's the place where you go to meet the underworld up there in the clouds. The easternmost point, soaring over eastern Sicily, is this rock. Like the prow of a great ship. And this is where Demeter stood, looking for her daughter. It's probable that 2,400 years ago, a temple to Demeter stood on this rock. Well, from this rock, not in this picture, but trust me, from this rock, off to the left, Mount Etna. Soaring high and pouring forth the underworld into this world with great force. Turn up to the right, and just over some rolling ground is a silver blue glint of Lake Perugusa, Lago Perugusa. The place, a lake perfectly round, with no inflow, very deep, but nothing flowing into it, so clearly the portal to the underworld. And you go down, and so you think down when you're standing there. So you have this cycle, you have Etna and then Perguza, and Etna Perguza, and here's this rock sitting right in the middle of it. And then looking out across, as this picture shows, you're looking across the plain of Britannia in eastern Sicily, the most fertile farmland in Sicily, more fertile than the Greeks had back home. And so where else would Persephone have been abducted rather than here? Where else is Demeter's story to be set other than here? It's the land demands it. There's Perguza. And so we begin with Ovid being, of the stories, the Homeric hymns version of this story is not set in Sicily. But that was written back when the Greeks hadn't anchored themselves here in any real way. But Ovid is telling us a story that is a Sicilian story because by the time the source that Ovid used had written it, this, it was clear that this was the place for this story. The land had said so. So he begins with a very Theocritian kind of bucolic opening. And what we have is a group of, I'm just going to tell this story in pieces because you all know it, so we have time to go through the detail, but a bunch of teenage girls were picking flowers along the lake, along the shore, and suddenly out of the black comes Hades, king of the underworld, bearded and terrible. He doesn't have his chariot here in Bernini's version. Chariots would be difficult to sculpt. but he should have a chariot. He snatches Persephone up, and off they go. Now, an older version of this story has Gaia setting the whole thing up. And that, what that takes us to is that a plan, a kind of fortunate fall, to use Christian terms, a coming to maturity that the world has to face. And so giving us a myth of being taken into maturity is why Gaia herself would have orchestrated this whole thing, because the earth has an understanding this is what mankind must do. Or the gods, the whole, in other words, nature itself must go through this. We must express it in a myth, in a story. Well, he races across eastern Sicily, and we've already seen this picture. You know, it's funny because I set these things up and I think, well, I have to show them this, I have to show them that, because most of them haven't been here. By this point of the conference, you know, two more days I wouldn't have to give this talk, because so much of this stuff is covered in pieces by everybody else. We've seen this slide twice now, the lectures I've been in, and I thought you guys would say, wow, we've never seen this before. But, so we're not going to tell the Chani story, however, it is, it's important to say that there's this nymph. He says, stop! Put this woman down, you cad! What she's remembering, she says, in fact, you have no right to take the girl without permission of her mother. And what's happening here is three different versions of the feminine standing up here. One, Demeter, who's back there, you know, wondering what happened to her daughter, but she, the mother's right to decide to her child is represented by Demeter and also represented by what Chani says, which is that you need the permission. You can't take the girl without permission. And Chani herself represents innocence. So you have all of these, and you have the Earth Mother, you have innocence, and you have the law, the maternal social law that says the mother has a right. It's both parents, but it's the mother in the Mediterranean who has that ultimate say. If you recall, Iphigenia and Aulis, Clytemnestra is outraged that Agamemnon should consent to marry his daughter without asking her permission in that play, Euripides' play. So that's being referred to. So all these feminine archetypes standing there saying, you can't do that. And here comes the male will. So we have that same moment that you find in tragedy in myth. Of course, we all know, and I claim it's consistent, is that the female, the earth, wins at the end always. But round one, in this case, boom, goes through. Who splashes down, and off he goes down into the underworld. And Fortiane weeps and weeps and becomes her own tears, which is beautiful. Again, there's the truth of Ovid, the truth of Ovid, only expressing the truth that the Greeks knew, this metamorphosis, the idea that in grief we become grief, right? We become our own tears until we can do the underworld journey and come out of it again. But in the myth, Tiane isn't given the option of coming back out of it. She falls into grief the way every grieving person does, becoming their own grief, becoming melted into their own tears, and then she stays that way because she becomes an archetype of grief. But that's, again, that's the beauty of that thing. Well, Mom comes by. And after a busy day of making the crops to grow, she comes to pick up her daughter at the lake, and her daughter's not there. And Mom said, what happened? Well, the girls who had been picking with flowers with chrysanthemum are speechless. Well, this is Sicily, after all. You know, nobody saw a thing, right? The guy gets shot in a crowded marketplace, and nobody saw a thing. But, no joke, because the fear of dark, hidden underground forces remains here and is easily transferable to other kinds of forces. So, of course, you don't say anything. But Geralt, angry at these girls, gives them wings and tells them to fly across the world and look for her daughter. But the girls, instead, traumatized, fly off to some rocks on the Campanian coast. And they sit, instead of looking for Persephone, they sit out there and they enact the revenge of the female against men by singing stories, singing not sexual glory, lure sailors to their death, not sexual songs, but songs of men's glory. So they lure men to their death by singing about their singing pride, you know, like saying that they will sing stories of their glorious deeds. Then they become the sirens. Well, Demeter comes up to the highest point, and that's when she looks for her daughter. And it is, you know, Ovid describes it very beautifully, again, about she goes with the fires of Etna, she's going through the night, and throughout the day, and throughout the night, and then the morning sun sees her. She's still been walking all night long with a torch from the fires of Etna, looking for her daughter. It's very poignant. Euripides reminds us, his account of this, he says in his Helen, his play Helen, quote, long ago, the mountain mother of all the gods, and the mountain mother of all the gods is Gaia. The mountain mother of all the gods, on flashing feet, ran in wild desire for the lost girl not to be named her daughter. So here's Euripides Demeter calling her Gaia. So we have this continuity of the female archetype, which, and as he traveled, Demeter grew ever more despondent, ever more miserable. And the land, of course, died. The crops died. The very fertile Sicily became less and less fertile. The grief of a raped and plundered earth. And the land expressed the grief because Demeter was angry. Is it not pathetic fallacy, as we later said in the 18th and 19th century, thinking that this was no longer a connection, they might have lost the connection. The land literally felt the grief. And here is the older view of the land. Here is a Sumerian grain goddess who is not the grain goddess. She is the grain. She is the land. So the things are growing out of her. She is actually the land. We haven't separated into a concept and reality. It is the land. Demeter is the land, really. Well, we all know what happens, and if you don't know what happens, if you were on my walking tour, we talked about it at the Pompeii of Tuesday, and if you haven't worked on that, we'll do it Monday. We know about the ending of the story, but what I want to say is that the land can live this story, nature can live this story joyfully. There's a message of hope that people want to take from this story, that religions want to take from this story. Every agricultural religion has this story in it, which is the story of regeneration, like if winter comes, can spring be far behind? Fine, nature redeems present suffering by delivering on its promise of rebirth. There she is, coming back to the upper world. Delivering on its promise of rebirth, the individual plant won't survive the cycle through winter, but the individual plant seed will, and the plant, and there's no differentiation between this year's plant and next year's plant. But Sicily is not fooled. Sicily is sadder but wiser, which is a concept that reflects this idea that when we come through with regeneration, we're not. The land knows better than this message of hope, and it teaches better. Plants may, whether or not you believe plants have consciousness, Plants don't have memory in the same way. There's no human comfort to be had from the idea of regeneration of a plant with seeds. We can pretend there is, but if our seed, if our child dies, me talking to you about genitive perception isn't going to solve your grief. We can't take nature's overview. This, I'm giving you Sicily's point of view. We can't take nature's overview. We can't take the overview of all mankind. We have people on a scale, a different scale, a small scale of individual life. Death is always a one-way door on that scale. Past pain and future death are all present every moment with us, which is to say they aren't the plan. So the worship of Demeter and Persephone became a major cult in Greek Sicily. This was the major form of worship. And I'm deeply moved when I read about discoveries in various cult sites of thousands of these coins, where people take these small statues to a temple. They're mass produced by the thousands. And people take them as offerings to the temple, knowing that the goddess feels the same grief I feel. And this is very deeply moving, that people, you get a sense of the human grief that someone carrying this thing towards the temple, feeling that grief. And Demeter's grieving over Persephone continues to be the major faith point of contact with the numinous for Sicily here. Except this time, it's Mary and Jesus. And we find at festivals like in Catena Nuova or Messina, on Holy Thursday, you find a procession with Mary at its head, a procession with Jesus, and they wandering through town, lost, trying to find each other, and they come together in the town square. It's a very beautiful moment, a family moment, a domestic moment. And now the church says, hooray, Jesus is resurrected. Easter is a time of joy. Sicily says, crap. What we're celebrating is the grieving mother. Mary is about the grieving mother. That's why Mary is the focus of Catholicism in the Mediterranean more than anywhere else. Because we want the big tragic message, which is that life is hell. And that suffering, we suffer. And the comfort that knows, that says, the God suffers as well, Mary being the goddess, that she suffers is a kind, that's all the redemption that's on offer. The idea that suffering is suffering, death is death, the child that died is not coming back. And every mother, whether she lost her child or she didn't, but every mother knows what it's feeling like to worry about losing a child, to worry, to imagine that child is dying. There's no comfort in holding that dead child. And saying, Michelangelo has missed the point. He's not a proper Sicilian because this has been elevated to beauty, kind of transcendent beauty. Death is horrible. Death is sad. It's miserable. And like Ciane, we dissolve into our grief, and it's not beautiful. And that is the grief of the weathered land. And I want to finish this notion of how that story. Because the story that so tells the Sicilian way of thinking, that, in other words, my point is that attitude of Sicily is handed it by the land. The land gives us this kind of point of view. The history of Sicily has that same pattern. And this is, again, it's not an original idea, but that Sicily is in the role of Persephone. The history of Sicily fits the myth as the role of Persephone. Persephone's original innocence can be seen, Persephone's innocence equates with Sicily's native beauty, its own native innocence before civilization stripped it, literally stripped it, and despoiled it. Theocritus gives us, in inventing the bucolic, inventing the pastoral genre, is giving us a Sicily before the Romans got their hands on it. And when the Romans got their hands on it, the rape of Rome is a way of the literal deflowering of Sicily. And what that reflects is a kind of the wheat sheaves on this picture of Medusa with the Trinacria, the wheat sheaves are added by Rome. Rome cut down the trees. And despite the land became dry, and they changed the climate by cutting down the trees. And localized climate change. And to turn it into wheat fields. So the curse of wheat which was handed to Sicily by the Romans, remained a curse leading up to the present day, and by a complicated argument, which we don't have time for, the Romans created the mafia, the weak economy. And the weak economy, of course, the mafia didn't appear until the 19th century, but it was that weak economy leading from slavery to feudalism, which is a long story, but it's the curse of wheat. And so Penelope's abduction becomes the rape of Penelope by civilization. The rape of Sicily, excuse me, by civilization. And more often than not, over the next two millennia, Sicily repeatedly was abducted by foreign powers. Twice Sicily was at the peak of civilization. Twice she had a glorious period, and Leonard mentioned, gave us one just this morning. Twice that was lost through a second dispolation, a second kind of rape. And now the once pastoral beauty has become a dry, stark beauty. And you can think in terms of these terms as the dry winds that blow across unforested Sicily are sort of like the lament of Persephone. And what that meant for the people is that you end up with a people who went from being the most advanced people in Western civilization to a people even up to recent times, as the most illiterate, some of the most illiterate and oppressed in Europe. And it was that, I should be showing this when I was talking about those ages of the rape of Sicily by various conquerors. It's a complex and sad picture, really. Ignore the red of the Sicanians is unbalances this thing. Really, it's Sicels where my normal story begins down here. Well, out of this tragedy comes, and forgive the personal story, comes Grandma. There she is. And freeing of Sicily that was mired in a millennium of unrelieved abuse and self-abuse. Well, Sicily, so much that's wrong with the island now is from this sense of tragedy about it, and this sense of being of desolation and being almost turning on itself, almost cannibalism, which it's now I'm maybe Pollyannish, but I see Sicily coming out again of this millennium of despair in present time. Well, let me finish. In a land where the present is past, can you get back up? In a land where the past is present and presumed to be prologue, in other words, timelessness, this land itself is empowered as a mentor. When I listen, I am sure that the land shapes our character, shapes our values, teaches us how to live on her back, holds us in dialogue through our agriculture, through the patterns of our social life, through our architecture, in numerous ways. She's also emotionally our mother. Her small, human-scale limestone valleys and fields hold us close to her, seem to contain our restless strivings, showing us how our presumed distinct identities, these are delusory senses of ourself, can dissolve in time into family resemblances as we erode back into our parents. The once distinct features of a limestone relief carving erode back into the rock and loses distinctiveness and becomes just the rock again where it started. Though our abandoned buildings erode back into the bedrock, our hillside towns gradually become the cliffs that they were quarried from. This is the Sicilian way of looking at that. The land's deep earth tones of loss, a story of disappointment, compromise, and subsequent grief and melancholy. The cycle turns, but if winter comes, can spring be found behind? Fine, spring comes, winter on its way. And Demeter's story of cycling through happiness, sorrow, and there's the wheel. And a person throwing yourself into this thing, you can throw yourself into the idea, you can begin to feel your own weathering, and perhaps come to terms with it in that way. So we can discuss the meaning of allegories. We can name archetypes, and point to the myths that identify them, that express them. But if you're going to grieve, you can wave your arms in the air and what seems to be the most futile and lonely of gestures. Or you can do the ritual, and you can fall upon the ground and grieve. And if you do that, at least you know you're in the bosom of your mother. Thank you. Thank you.